It's wonderful to be with you again. I think I was here 2.5 or 3 years ago when I was invited to come this time. David Fetterman at the time invited me to come in February for a month. And I said, with all due respect, I live 40 minutes away. I lived in North Carolina for 15 years before I moved up to Pennsylvania. I would just assume not have the stress of wondering every Sunday morning if I'm going to be able to get to where I need to go. So maybe there's a better month. And so we found September. I didn't realize it would be kicking off your year, but there is some logic to this. Henry Nouwen, I'm sure some of you have heard of Henry Nouwen and have read his works, but he is one of the great spiritual writers of the 20th century, again and again helping us plumb the depths of our life with God and our mission, our vocation in the world. And he really popularized, he was deep but a simple writer, clear, direct, nothing complicated or convoluted, unlike, say, Thomas Merton, who we'll get into a little bit later this morning. But Henry Nouwen really had a very simple understanding of what he called the journey inward and the journey outward. The journey inward and the journey outward. That is, it's not necessarily sequential, but there's some logic to thinking about it that way. That we begin by thinking about our lives rooted and grounded in the agency of God and openness to that. And as we begin to become attuned and attentive to how God is moving in our lives, then we're more able, our eyes are more open to see how God is moving in the world so that we can participate in the work of God in the world most faithfully and truly. And so there is some sense to beginning this way. So we're going to be talking about Christian spirituality and Christian spiritual formation. Spirituality always perennially popular, perennially popular topic. I was in California a couple times in July, and at one time I was in a little town in Southern California, and I walked down the main street, and there were at least three stores that were completely to do with spirituality, none of them to do with Christian spirituality, and they were the only stores that were packed when I went in. Books on all kinds of things and different kinds of crystals and right, this wanting to be, this sense of wanting to belong to what the folks there might call the oneness, right? And this desire for connection in an adversarial, atomistic age. Christian spirituality, perennially popular. So we're going to talk about Christian spirituality, and that's really our topic today. Just jumping right in, what is Christian spirituality? What is Christian spiritual formation? What are these things we call spiritual disciplines, and what role do they play in our lives? How do we engage them? That might have been the reason the thought was to invite me in February, because we usually talk about spiritual disciplines around Lent, right? Because we might take up a spiritual discipline, but it's helpful to think that these things are avenues towards openness to God we might want to engage in all of our lives. So what are these things called spiritual disciplines? So today's talk will be largely foundational, I think. And if you were here 2.5 years ago, you will overhear resonances of what I spoke about 2.5 years ago, because 2.5 years ago I was talking about reading Scripture as a spiritual practice. So the approach to Christian spirituality will be the same, largely. And so then the next 3 weeks, I'm going to hope to build on this approach, first by talking about a spiritual practice you've probably never heard of next week that I call the practice of letting go of our agendas, and which I think is particularly, as Sarah said, necessary in this adversarial age. So yeah, you can skip that day if you want. The practice of letting go of our agendas, because of course the practice of letting go of our agendas begins with becoming aware of the agendas we didn't even know we had. And that's the painful part. That might be just coming halfway through. And then the next week, I want to talk about another spiritual practice that's been consistent throughout 2,000 years of Christian spiritual tradition and even in Jewish tradition before that. And that's the practice of having a soul friend or a spiritual friend, or what we might today call a spiritual director. I don't know if that's become a common language around here, but at least in the last 20 or 30 years, in Protestant Christianity, the notion of having a spiritual director, a soul friend, a spiritual guide. There are lots of words for it. So we'll talk through that practice as well, and hopefully open our eyes to maybe a hidden practice of the spiritual traditions in Christianity that we're not all as familiar with. And then in the fourth week, we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to introduce you to a 20th century Quaker mystic named Thomas Kelly. Thomas Kelly, in the early part of the 20th century, wrote what really has been a classic of Christian devotional literature called A Testament of Devotion. Is there any chance someone in here has read the book A Testament of Devotion? Oh, good. So it really will be an introduction. You might want to write that. I don't know if you have a pen, but it's such a small little book. I don't know if you like to read between sessions. It's such a small little book. Thomas Kelly, A Testament of Devotion, that as we get to that fourth week, if you checked out a copy from the library or you found a copy on Amazon to read, you will find it very edifying. But you won't need to read it because I come armed with copious quotations, so you'll be fine. So in that way, we'll explore this terrain of opening our lives to God, both the challenge and the promise of approaching our whole lives as increasingly open and available to the work of God's Spirit in us. I kind of like to begin with a poem sometimes. And Denise Levertov is one of my favorite poets. There's a poem on the front of your page called In Whom We Live and Move and Have Our Being. You'll recognize that as a quotation from the book of Acts. Denise Levertov was a prolific and important poet in the 20th century who converted to Catholicism later in her life. And she has a beautiful little volume of poems called The Stream and the Sapphire, in which are collected a number of her poems on religious themes, moving through her conversion and then her coming to a place of faith. So I just encourage you to listen to this. And I'm wondering, I think this says something about our spiritual lives and our lives with God. So pay attention to the images or the words or the phrases that speak to you or touch you in this poem, because I'm going to ask you, after I read it twice, which ones touch you or speak to you. In whom we live and move and have our being. Birds afloat in air's current. Sacred breath? No, not breath of God, it seems, but God, the air, enveloping the whole globe of being. It's we who breathe in, out, the sacred, leaves astir, our wings rising, ruffled. But only the saints take flight. We cower in cliff crevice or edge out gingerly on branches close to the nest. The wind marks the passage of holy ones riding the ocean of air. Slowly their wake reaches us, rocks us, but storm or still, numb or poised in attention, we inhale, exhale, inhale, encompassed, encompassed. So just take a moment in the silence, perhaps, and read through that again on your own. I'll read it again out loud. Notice those words or phrases, images that speak to you about the Christian spiritual life or life with God. I'll read it again. Birds afloat in air's current, sacred breath. No, not breath of God, it seems, but God, the air enveloping the whole globe of being. It's we who breathe in, out, the sacred, leaves astir, our wings rising, ruffled, but only the saints take flight. We cower in cliff crevice or edge out gingerly on branches close to the nest. The wind marks the passage of holy ones riding that ocean of air. Slowly their wake reaches us, rocks us, but storm or still, numb or poised in attention, we inhale, exhale, inhale, encompassed, encompassed. What do you notice in that poem that sticks out to you, that speaks to you about this spiritual life or relationship with God? Anything? Any images or words or phrases that you find striking? Yes?
I like the opening because it reminds me of when we were at the Grand Canyon and you could see the falcons just floating on the air currents.
Yeah.
When I meditate, which I do from time to time, I often allow myself to feel that floating. So that's personal to me, but what really struck me as godlike is that I think we're raised to believe that God is in heaven, but God is all around us. God is the air that we breathe and the life.
Okay, so the sense, she was remembering the Grand Canyon, watching the hawks float on thermals, and the sense, especially in meditative prayer, that is a sense that she has. And it helps us remember that God is not somewhere else. God is not up there, but God, this sense is that God is all around us. I sense that from this poem as well. Yeah, thank you. What else? Yes, in the back.
I grudgingly like and acknowledge the image of staying close to the nest.
Yes, right. So grudgingly acknowledging the staying close to the nest. I do think that, I mean, that touches me. It speaks to me. I mean, she's making this distinction between us and the saints, you know, but the point is to say that life with God might feel risky or dangerous when you have to let go, right? And so we're happy to just stay close to the nest. Yeah. On the other hand, there's something comforting about that. Because your point remains, whether we're close to the nest or they're out there floating, encompassed either way, right? Yes?
I get an image that we're like baby birds in a nest. And if we get out and move our wings, the air is God. Without the air, the wings wouldn't work. And so we don't trust our own wings. So we have to trust the air, which is an image of God, I think.
This image that the air is what holds up the baby bird, and the baby bird has to trust the air. If we're the baby birds, to let go, to leave the branch or the nest requires trusting that there's something we don't see, nonetheless holding us up. It might be that the baby bird thinks his or her wings are doing the job, but it's this work of the air all around us. How about one more? Anybody? Yeah. I like that. The rhythm of inhale and exhale is completely organic, and we don't think about it. And so even though we're not thinking about it, she's affirming the sense that there's no real separation. Sometimes if we imagine God up there, then we imagine I got to do something to get to God, right? How do I bridge this gap, or how does God? But there's this sense in here that there's no. It's very Augustinian. If you've had maybe my colleague Ken Wu come and talk about church history, he'll talk about Augustine. And Augustine went on this search for God and was all through these different spiritual traditions, Manichaeism and Platonism. And finally, he gets to Christianity. He's convinced intellectually, but it takes him a while to convert all the way. But when he does, he says, "You are closer to me than my very breathing." He says, "God, you're closer to me than my very inmost self. You were here and I didn't know it. I went searching for you, and when I found you, I found you right where I was when I began," right? There's this sense, no separation. I think these images in here help us get at some of the things we'll want to say about Christian spirituality and the spiritual life. So look at your handout. I believe I have a couple definitions. I should really have a handout because it's possible that I've... Is there an extra handout someplace? Thank you. Because it's possible that I will forget. Nope, I didn't forget yet. So far, we're good. So here's a little definition there by Robert Mulholland. Very short. Robert Mulholland was a New Testament professor at Asbury Theological Seminary. He says Christian spiritual formation is the process of being formed in the image of Christ for the sake of others. The process of being conformed to the image of Christ for the sake of others. And I'm just curious, and that little definition is very simple, succinct, straightforward. Later in life, he added a comma, for the sake of others, for the sake of the world. He wanted to expand the definition a little bit. But what do you notice about that definition? What does it take into account? What, even though it's simple, what parts of it stick out to you? What seem important? Yes?
Process.
Okay. He says it's a process of being conformed, as opposed to something instantaneous. And process invites us, this idea of process invites us into patience. Right? Into patience, letting go of this sense that I'm in control of how this transformation happens, what it's going to end up like and how to make it happen. But it's a process. It takes time. Thank you. What else do you notice? Yeah.
That it gives the point to it, and it's not my own salvation.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the purpose of the impact I can have with others around the world.
Yeah, for the sake of others, for the sake of the world. The spirituality that I encountered on the coast of California was for me, largely. It was about my own inner peace, my own sense of serenity, my own getting in touch with who I really am. Now, I think people who have inner peace and a sense of serenity and who are in touch with who they truly are better for the world, right? We need more of those kinds of folks. But this is explicit, right? If we were, you know, using pompous language, we would say this definition is teleological. It has an endpoint. And the endpoint is the benefit of the world, the transformation of the world. Thank you for pointing that out. So it's a process. It's not for myself alone, but it's for others, for the world. What else do you notice? Yeah.
I call it agape love.
Agape love. Yeah. Love that surrenders. Yeah. Right. Thank you. Anything else? Seems significant? I think there's one phrase right there in the middle that's pretty important. The process of being conformed to the image of Christ. So it's also, to use another pompous theological term, it's Christocentric. It's Christ-centered. It's also particular. So Christian spirituality isn't... There are lots of ways to talk about spirituality, many of which can be helpful. But in Christian spirituality, we're talking about a Christocentric, Christ-centered way of being in the world. So we've got process of being conformed to the image of Christ for the sake of others, teleological, for the sake of the world. A handy little way of thinking about what we're doing in here and what we do when we gather as a Christian community to be formed and to be shaped. How are we being shaped into the image of Christ? Yeah.
Another part of that is if you're in the image of Christ, you're not just doing things to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why you do it.
Okay.
And what makes Christ do what he did,
mm-hmm.
just to do good things,
mm-hmm.
there's something missing if that's the way you see it.
Right.
Being formed in the image of Christ just so that I can be a do-gooder or do good things.
Yeah.
It has to do with how you see others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
As a brother or a sister, you want to help them because you love
right,
them.
Right, right. My meditation this morning was on 1 John. We love others, our brothers and sisters. We abide in love because God first loved us. And so it's not just doing good for the sake of doing good, but it's a transformation of vision. It's a transformation of vision, right? How we see not only our own good works, but the others in whom we're in relationship, So there's another definition on there that I think is also a beautiful though a little more wordy, but it's going to give you something to work with. Marjorie Thompson says, this is from her book Soul Feast. I probably failed to put that on there. Scripturally speaking, the spiritual life is simply the increasing vitality and sway of God's Spirit in us. It is a magnificent choreography of the Holy Spirit in the human spirit, moving us toward communion with both Creator and creation. The spiritual life is thus grounded in relationship. It has to do with God's way of relating to us and our way of responding to God. Take a minute just to read through that again, because I'm going to ask you the same question, though. It's not as sort of a definition. But what sticks out to you in that understanding of the spiritual life? What do you notice in there that seems significant? Yeah.
In the last line, talking about your devotion, reminded me or pointed out to me that it starts with God's way of relating to us, our responding to God. So there's an order there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that conversation, but there's step one, step two.
Yeah. Right. It's not. Did you hear what she said? She was focusing on this. That it's as if to speak of God's initiative in the relationship and our response. And we'll see when we get to Thomas Kelly in a few weeks, the Quaker. He says very explicitly, even when we imagine it's our initiative, what appears our initiative is already a response to God. And I think Presbyterians who have read your Calvin would find that an amenable way of thinking about God's work. It's always already our God-enabled response to God. We Methodists talk about prevenient grace, the work of God that always goes before us. Marjorie Thompson's husband was a spiritual writer named John McGabgab, and he said that there is no path to God that is not first God's path to us. There is no path to God that is not first God's path to us. What else do you notice in here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she's highlighting this word choreography. Were others of you struck by that word? I love that image, right? You get this, I mean, you get the response there, but if you think about this dance, it adds a depth to this notion of response. I mean, I was thinking about when my wife and I were learning to swing dance. And we'd go to dance lessons, and we loved to dance. And you get increasingly, when one is leading and the other's following, in this kind of dancing, you get increasingly attuned to the most subtle gestures and moves of the one in the lead, so that you're always responding to one another. So to think of it as a dance, I think, is a beautiful way to understand this relationship. Yeah. What else? Yes. Mm-hmm.
The vitality and sway.
Mm.
So alive.
Yeah, vitality and sway. It's not. It's God's work is not inert, but right. But it's there's a sense of joy. It goes with the dance image, right? Joy, maybe a little spontaneity in there. I mean, it occurs to me that those are three ways three ways of really saying the same thing. Because when you talk about the increasing vitality and sway of God's Spirit, or the choreography where God's theoretically is leading and we're responding, or you just, she says it explicitly, it's God's initiative and we respond. We're always highlighting we might call it the primacy of God's agency in the spiritual life. The primacy of God's agency in the spiritual life. Kind of like that poem we read. This sense of encompassed, this not the little birdie who's keeping himself or herself in the air, but it's the uplift of the wind. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, over here.
There's an ongoing Harvard study for the past 75 years. They track their graduates, and one of the see them in different phases of their lives in order to find out what's the key to happiness. And ultimately, it's the social connections, and isolation kills the graduates who were on their own, die quicker, had disease capacity. So if we're so wired to be social creatures, we're so wired socially on a human level, see how much more powerful our human interaction can be if we have this relationship.
Yeah, thank you. I've heard about that study, and this is it's kind of a, someone who understands Christian spirituality would read that study and say, we're not surprised at all. We're made for relationship. We say you're created in the divine image, and the divine image is a community of self-giving love without loss. Right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, always and ever from eternity, giving oneself into the other without fear of loss. So why wouldn't we find ourselves truly who we are in relationship and happiness, flourishing vitality in relationship with others? But this brings in that explicit, two other explicit connections, right? That study would have left out, that relationship with God, that sense that it infuses the whole, and the relationship with all of creation. The sense that Christian spirituality leads us away from a sense of isolation from the rest of the created world. So it's a fulsome understanding of relationship. In Christian spirituality, we're deepening our sense of our place in the koinonia of all that is, the community of all that is. Even as Christian spirituality wants to acknowledge that human beings have a unique place in that relationship in all of creation. Psalm 8. But what are human beings that you are mindful of them? But you have made them a little lower than the angels or a little lower than God, depending on what tradition you're reading, right? So what translation you're reading. Wonderful. Thanks for pointing that out. Yeah. Anything else in there? I mean, it's just such a rich, we could just spend the whole hour just playing with these two definitions, because it's unlikely that I really want to say a lot more than what they have already said. I have my notes on here. If I were in your seat and someone were asking me these questions, I would point out in this definition that the primacy is on God's agency. The first definition talked about being conformed to the image of Christ. This talks about the vitality and sway of the Holy Spirit and about God more generally. So it's a fulsome, God-centered understanding. We've already talked about relationship to God and creation, and that it's our response. I have on your handout, I try to kind of pull these two things together. I don't know why, because I don't think you can improve on them. But one time in my life, I must have thought this was a pretty decent definition of spiritual formation, though we won't spend a lot of time on it, or any time really. Spiritual formation is the process. I liked that word process. I think... understanding the ongoing nature of this is important. Of becoming increasingly open and available. Increasingly open and available to the transformings, to God's transforming spirit in our lives. It's that bird edging out. Can we increasingly sneak away from the crevice where we feel so safe? Because being open and available feels vulnerable. To God. I think the last time I was here, I shared another favorite poem of Denise Levertov's of mine that begins this way. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall. You hear that? It's very similar to this. I mean, it's a similar theme to the poem we worked with today. But sometimes when I share that poem with folks, they highlight that word, that beginning word, dare. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky. It's that bird inching out on the limb. So becoming increasingly open and available to God's transforming work in our lives, making us more like Christ as we grow in the love of God and service to others. So trying to keep that teleological, growing in the love of God and service to others, and the Christocentric, the Christ-centered nature of these things. Now, there are different ways to think about this, different perspectives, depending on whom you read or you're talking to. And so I emphasize, and I will this week and next week and the week after that, the idea of receptivity in Christian spirituality, the receptivity in Christian spirituality. And let me tell you a little story that gets to one of the reasons I emphasize, if not overemphasize, the notion of receptivity in Christian spirituality and spiritual formation. So I was preaching in my congregation in North Carolina, and I once admitted that my gift as a leader was not getting things done or getting things started. I didn't have these entrepreneurial gifts. I had taken an assessment called Strength Finder 2.0. Have any of you familiar with that? The Strength Finder. And it has a list of 30 strengths, and you take the assessment, and it tells you which area, maybe four or five different areas that your strengths could fall in. And all of my strengths fell in the area that the assessment called, I think generously, ideation. Ideation. I think a less generous assessment would have called it the strength of idle daydreaming, right? Of sitting around and thinking things up. I would always say that there are three kinds of people in congregations: thinker-uppers, worker-outers, and getter-dunners. And I was solidly in the first camp. And anyone who'd ever come in my office would have known that that's where my gift was, because my books were like To Do, Doing, Done. I was always buying books on how to get things done, or my favorite was called Making Ideas Happen. I was really good at coming up with the ideas part, not quite as good as making them happen part. And so there was a guy in the church named Jim who was an entrepreneur. He was a specialist at working things out and getting them done. He would start businesses and get them going, and then he'd sell them because he wanted to start something else. And so he gave me a call after church that day, and he said, "Roger, I'm wondering if you're going to be around for a little while. I'd like to bring you a book." And I thought, I'll always take a free book. And so about 20 minutes later, he showed up at the door, and he had what some of you will recognize as a classic business book to give me called In Search of Excellence. It was the 20th anniversary edition, I think. And he said, "You can skip the first four chapters. Just skip to chapter 5. That's the important one." And then we walked out onto my driveway where my kids were drawing with sidewalk chalk, and we chatted. And the whole time I was thinking, I wish you'd just drive away in your little sports car so I could get back inside and see what's so important about chapter 5. Well, finally Jim drove away, and so I went back inside, and I turned to chapter 5. And chapter 5 is called A Bias for Action. The best companies have a bias for action, right? And I took that as an appropriate critique. Sometimes the thinking up, the sitting around, the needing to get it right, the not doing something until you've got it all figured out needs to stop, and the action needs to begin. You've got to take a step out. You've got to be Peter, right, and step out of the boat. You've got to be the birdie and get away from the crevice eventually. You've got to do something. On the other hand, I believe we live in a pervasively bias for action culture that emphasizes, perhaps more than we need to, getting things done, making something happen, achieving something. And our bias for action culture can be a mask of what the Quaker writer Parker Palmer calls functional atheism. Think about those two words, functional atheism. Palmer says functional atheism is the belief that ultimate responsibility for everything rests with us. Any of you suffer that? The belief that ultimate responsibility for everything rests with us. He says it's the belief that, in practice, that if anything good is going to happen around here, it's up to us to make it happen. And then he adds, and I think this is just kind of twisting the knife. He says, it's particularly prevalent among people who can talk a good game of God. Functional atheism, particularly prevalent among people who can talk a good game of God. And I think, I mean, this would be a different question to talk about how functional atheism shows up in the life of congregations and communities and more broadly in our culture. What I want to talk about is how this bias for action, this functional atheism, can slip into and infect our relationship with God, our understanding of our spiritual lives. Think, for instance, about that famous verse in Philippians chapter 2 that says, It's after the Christ hymn in Philippians chapter 2 about Christ letting go of the prerogatives of divinity, humbling himself, becoming obedient to death on a cross, and then God highly exalting him. Paul says to the Philippians, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, enabling you both to will and to work for God's good pleasure. You see the two sides of that? Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, enabling you both to will and to work for God's good pleasure. And in the best of worlds, there can be a deep integration, a consonance, a unity between what we might call this paradox of the spiritual life, these two sides. But from my perspective as a pastor working in a congregation for a number of years, and now as a professor who teaches spirituality and sees eager, excited, first-year seminarians not completely patient with the process of becoming transformed, but wanting it now. You know, what can I do? What can I do now? I see that we can often get the balance wrong. And we hang out over here all the time in the work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So we love the metaphors in Scripture about running the race, or I like beat my body, or I, you know, the active metaphors that give us something to do because we're uncomfortable not having something to do. So we talk about spiritual disciplines and spiritual practices, things that we can engage in. And don't get me wrong, I think these are significant aspects of the Christian spiritual life. It's part of it. Notice, I think on your handout, I have a quote from the 16th century Saint Ignatius of Loyola from his Spiritual Exercises. You see that? Do I have it there? Okay, yes. By the term spiritual exercises, and his Spiritual Exercises is a classic and very valuable, but I just want to highlight the language he uses at the beginning. We mean every method of examination of conscience, meditation, contemplation, vocal or mental prayer, and other spiritual activities. For just as taking a walk, traveling on foot, and running are physical exercise, so is the name of spiritual exercises given to any means of preparing and disposing our soul to rid itself of all disordered affections, and then, after their removal, of seeking and finding God's will in the ordering of our life for the salvation of our soul. I'm exhausted just reading that. But who is the agent in this? Who's the agent? Who's doing the work here?
The individual.
The individual, right? I'm disposing my soul. I'm ridding them of disordering affections. I'm seeking and finding God. I'm ordering my life for the salvation of my soul. So the emphasis here is on me, on my agency. Now, I don't want to paint that as a picture of Ignatius all the way, because this is just at the beginning. He certainly has a much richer theological perspective. But you see that, you see the language. That's working out my own salvation with fear and trembling. On the other hand, we can't ignore our own participation. Notice what Marjorie Thompson says. It's the next quotation on your handout. It would be nice if we could simply practice the presence of God in all of our life without expending energy on particular exercises. But the capacity to remember and abide in God's presence comes only through steady training. If we wish to see, name, and love Christ in the flesh of daily existence, we will eventually need some kind of intentional practice of spiritual discipline. So I'm not suggesting that there are no practices in which we can engage, but Thompson goes on to say, this is not on your handout, she goes on to say that she's understood spiritual disciplines to be called windows onto grace. Transparent means by which we allow ourselves to be available to God's grace. But she says that they can become distorted and opaque if we allow them to be used for the wrong reasons. So she says we can engage in prayer and meditation because of the sense of peace and serenity we get at the end. That's using a spiritual discipline for the wrong reasons. Or we might engage in hospitality as a way, in the end, of showing off for others. of letting others see how generous and hospitable we are. So that's a way a spiritual discipline can get distorted. And so the question is, when we're thinking about work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, we have to be aware that our engaging in spiritual exercises can become distorted and opaque.
It's nothing personal. It's just
the choir. Oh, I know. It's the choir leading. Seems like a good time for me to have a sip of tea. So some of the Christian spiritual traditions, and especially Thomas Merton, give us what I think is helpful language. Have any of you heard of Thomas Merton? Okay, so Thomas Merton is perhaps the great 20th century spiritual writer. Joined the monastery in around 1940 when he was 26 years old, fleeing the world, a kind of tortured soul, but deeply in tune with the existential anxieties of his age, following them throughout the 20th century. He died actually 50 years ago this December, so in 1968. And by the 1960s, even though he was still a hermit, he had been a monk, but then in about 1960 they allowed him to be a hermit. And this goes to the question of inner journey and outer journey, Sarah. In the 1960s, he was writing on race, on the Vietnam War, on nuclear proliferation. So he was deeply engaged with the struggles and troubles. He would train anti-racism activists. They would come to the monastery and meet with him, and he would train them in nonviolent resistance, for instance. So he was deeply engaged in the life of the world near the end of his life, but that came out of this real sense of the journey with God. So he gives us this language that you've likely heard, but no one really talked about before Merton, which is the language of the false self and the true self. Have you heard that language before? The false self and the true self. The person who writes about it most today is Richard Rohr. So he's kind of the popularizer of these kinds of things. And I think the language of the false self, when you understand it through Merton and others, is helpful in diagnosing why we have this functional atheism, this bias for action, or we get this balance wrong. So notice I have another quote from Robert Mulholland on your handout, describing or defining the false self. He says the false self, I just want to make sure, I don't know what page that's on. I just want to make sure, are you there? Do you see that definition? Okay. He says it's a mode of being in the world, decentered from life in God. So you get that picture, a mode of being in the world, how we exist in the world, decentered from life in God, although seeking to retain God on its own terms. How helpful, right? Sometimes God, you know, works for us and can make us look good, right? A mode of being that creates its own structures of identity. So it's a way of wanting to be in control of who we are and who we're seen to be. And a mode of being that determines for itself the nature of its own being. It's a way of being in the world that wants to lay its own foundation, discover and decide its own being in the world. Later on, Mulholland says it's a pervasively self-referential way of being. A pervasively self-referential way of being. Now think about how different that is from those definitions, those ends for which we said Christian spirituality aims. Transformation in the image of Christ for the sake of others, for the sake of the world, responsive to the vitality and sway of God's Spirit within us. But Mulholland is saying more often than not, we live in the world through a pervasively self-referential mode of being. Augustine says that our hearts are turned in on themselves. That's his way of describing sin. Hearts turned in on those incurvatus in se. Our hearts are turned in on themselves. So the false self is a way of trying to establish and then defend. Because if you've established your own identity, then you got to spend the rest of your life defending your own identity against those forces that would love to expose you for the imposter you are. Establish and defend our own self-created identities. to grab and control as a way of being, to possess, use other things for its own purposes. I like to think of the false self as its own center of gravity, because I think it's an image from, you know, elementary school. We can picture the solar system images, right? In its own center of gravity, it's not you know, Pluto, the now demoted dwarf planet of 10 years ago, but it's this sun. It's in the center. We want to be the center of our own lives. That's the false self. And it pulls other things and people and ideas and ideologies and practices and communities into its orbit and holds on to them. You might be thinking of people who try to pull you into their orbit just insofar as you're good for them. You help them feel good about themselves. You support their self-created identities. Well, that's what we all do to a certain extent. I think part of what the journey of the parent as children leave home and grow up is to let go of them, but they did so much for us, right? They helped us know who we are. My mother struggled with this so much when all her kids were gone and she, her identity was mom. That's who she was. That's how she understood herself in the world. And as soon as that didn't work anymore, she kind of fell apart because she didn't have a deeper sense of who she is that could replace this image of her as mom, right? And that's hard for adult children, right? When the parent can't let go of this, the central identity as parent, right? So we have these false identities. We pull other people, things, scripture. And I just want to say we can pull our own spiritual practices. That's how they become distorted. When we pull our own spiritual practices, our life with God, and you don't have to look out in the world very far to see how God gets pulled into false selves. Because we use these things to defend who we think we are, to shore up, like retaining walls, our self-created identities, because they're very fragile. These identities we've worked so hard to create for ourselves, the sense of self, it's very fragile. And so we need all these things to hold it up. It's a false self. Thomas Merton, I have some long quotations here, but I want us to have some time for conversation. So I'm not going to read all about Merton. But in a wonderful book called The New Man, he calls this a Promethean theology or a Promethean spirituality. So he's reminding us of that Greek myth of Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods and gave that fire to humanity. And he said, we're like Prometheus in that we think we have to steal our truest self, who we really are. We have to steal it. And if we don't steal it, it's not ours. If we don't steal, if we don't possess it on our own terms, it's not ours. So we have to steal our truest identity from God, who doesn't want to give it to us. And he says, but Prometheus, we, like Prometheus, have it all wrong, right? We've got God wrong because we think God wants to hold back the fire of our identity, which is also the fire of God's own love from us. And we've got ourselves wrong because we don't think we're somebody unless we've managed to steal or secure our identity from God. We have no idea what it means to live in this world, understanding that our own identities, our truest selves, and our relationship with God is sheer gift. Sheer gift. Given. Given. Not earned. Given. Not stolen. Given. That throws us out of whack because it upsets everything we understand about what it means to be human, to get on in this world. To get on in this world. So Merton writes, there's a long Merton quotation that I kind of like. I always say I'm not going to read these, but then I do. One of the real reasons, Merton writes, why Prometheus is condemned to be his own prisoner is because he is incapable of understanding the liberality of God. The fire he thinks he has to steal is, after all, his own fire. God created this spiritual fire for his own sons and daughters. More than that, he gives them his own uncreated and sanctifying fire, which is the Holy Spirit. But Prometheus, who does not understand liberality, since he has none himself, refuses the gift of God. Here is the central reason for his inescapable feeling of guilt. He condemns himself to frustration. He cannot enjoy the gift of God unless he snatches it away when God is not looking. This is necessary, For Prometheus demands that the fire be his by right of conquest. Otherwise, he will not believe it is really his own. So for Merton, we live as false selves. To live as a false self is to live a life grounded in the belief that through snatching and clinging, we must secure our own existence and ground our reality in ourselves. And in the process of doing that, we can use these things called spiritual disciplines or Christian spirituality or our relationship with God. We can pull that into our orbit to help ground our sense of identity, our sense of relationship with God. And so that's what Marjorie Thompson means, which I alluded to earlier, when she says a discipline can become opaque, reflecting our own distortive motives. Spiritual disciplines, like all good things, can be pursued for the wrong reasons. If our motives are distorted, the practice will not yield good results. But there's an alternative to this picture of distorted spiritual practices, a warped vision. I think I have a quotation by a guy named Richard Foster. Some of you, if you've read about spiritual disciplines, you've likely read Richard Foster's book, A Celebration of Discipline. He writes, "By themselves, the spiritual disciplines can do nothing. They only get us to where something can be done." Did you hear that shift? By themselves, they can do nothing. They can only get us to where something can be done. They are the means by which we place ourselves where God can bless us. You see how that's an alternative picture? It's an affront to the false self. The false self that wants to do something, make something happen, achieve on its own, become somebody. And he says spiritual disciplines aren't about that at all. But they're about discovering how to live with God in the passive voice. False selves are not good at living in the passive voice. Placing ourselves where something can be done. Here's how I like to think of it, an image, not unlike the image of the little bird that we were pointed to earlier. So when I was a pastor, one of the great privileges was baptizing a baby. I don't get to do that enough anymore. And my little church doesn't have, where I worship, doesn't have enough young parents. I don't even get to see it that much anymore. But every time I would baptize a baby or watch my wife baptize a baby, you know, we think of baptism as the new birth, right? Methodists say you're born through water and the Spirit in baptism. And I couldn't help but to think that just a few months earlier, this baby was born for the first time. The first birth. And if it finds this sprinkling traumatic, if it cries now, imagine how traumatic that first birth must have felt for the baby. I mean, if you think about it, it basically had like a 9-month spa, right? Just a spa bath, warm water, surrounded, muted sounds, the gentle undulating of the water, and perhaps most important, that heartbeat of the mother, boom, boom. Boom, 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 boom. That rhythmic, a secure, comforting heartbeat. And then what must have seemed like all of the sudden, it didn't seem like all of the sudden for the mother, but for the baby it must have seemed like all of the sudden, right? There's bright lights and cold air and lots of loud noises. And so what does the baby do? It cries, it screams, it wails, it makes these little tight fists and it shakes its little blue legs and hands. It just screams. It had no idea it had this capacity to scream and to wail so much. And if all goes well, it doesn't always go. I've been in the delivery room when it didn't go the way we would have wanted it to. But if all goes well, the baby is whisked away to the corner and it's wiped and it's prodded and it's measured and it's poked and it's weighed. All the while, it's wailing the whole time. But then maybe somebody, a midwife or a parent or a grandparent or a nurse, wraps up the baby and takes it back to the mom and lays it on the mother's chest And the baby begins to calm down because it's warm again. And it's quiet again. And most importantly, it hears that heartbeat again. Boom, 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 boom. And it realizes, I'm home. I'm back where I belong. Now, at that moment, you know what the baby is thinking? I do. It's thinking, it worked! All that wailing and screaming and crying, it worked. It got me right back where I wanted to be. It worked. I'm going to do this the rest of my life. But we know better, don't we? We know it had to be lifted and carried. There was no other way. And our truest home is next to the heartbeat of God. That's where we belong. And we can imagine that we're going to make that a life plan, my first year spiritual formation students. They're going to get themselves back there. Right? We're going to work. We're going to make a plan. We're going to practice these disciplines. In Lent, we're even going to turn it up on our disciplines. Right? And we're going to get ourselves back to where we belong. But it doesn't work that way. We can get there, but not as false selves. Because we have to be lifted and carried. We have to allow ourselves to be taken back to our truest home. The hardest work of the spiritual life, and it's sometimes what the spiritual disciplines help us to do, the hardest work of the spiritual life, and it really feels like hard work, like screaming and yelling, is the work of letting go of the idea that we're the ones whose job it is to do the work. That we're the ones whose job it is to propel ourselves down the road of holiness or righteousness. So we have these things called spiritual disciplines. And when put in the right perspective, we can see them as practices we can engage in that help us allow ourselves to be lifted and carried. That help us allow ourselves to be open to the transforming work of God's Spirit. That help us allow ourselves to be increasingly open and available to the work of God. Now, it looks like we're right at 10:45. And the good news is, what's left on your handout is complete repetition from when I was here 2.5 years ago. So I don't need to repeat myself, but I do want to, you can go home and meditate on this list of words. And even think more broadly just about what we've talked about in general. But I want to invite us to think about what's a posture? What does it mean to, how do we approach spiritual disciplines? So I've listed there 7 or 8 characteristics of what it means to approach these things, allow ourselves to be lifted and carried as we try to find our ways back to this relationship with God, with others, and with all of creation. Now, I can hang around here a little bit longer and we can have some questions if you'd like, but if you need to rush out and grab your seat in worship, that's fine too. But if you have any comments or questions, I'm happy to entertain them or have some conversation.
We'll just do it.
All right.
Adjourn.
Yes, right. We can just adjourn, and then we can speak individually. Wonderful. Thanks for being here today, and for your and especially for your attentiveness and alertness. I really appreciate that.